From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. Today, we kick off Season 11, a series of interviews focusing on the opioid crisis. How did the opioid crisis come to be? What is it like to walk the path of addiction and recovery with a loved one? Who are the people who become addicted to opioids? This season, we'll be exploring these questions and many more. My guest today is Dr. David Jetmore. A retired ENT and otolaryngologist, Dr. Jetmore practiced medicine in Richmond, Indiana, and the surrounding area for nearly 40 years. He currently serves as the Wayne County Health Officer. He also happens to be my dad. Dr. David Jetmore, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kate.
You're welcome. It's great having you here. As we mentioned in the intro, you are currently the health officer in Wayne County, Indiana. Could you just let us know what that position entails and how you came to be in that position?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was asked by the Wayne County Health Department to be the Wayne County Health Officer, and my first question is, what is the Wayne County Health Officer? This is a position that is appointed by the Board of Health to a four-year term. You have to be an MD, but no other requirement other than that. I was totally unprepared to take this position in that my knowledge of public health was minuscule. I'd spent my life as a head and neck surgeon, and I was more interested in curing disease than in preventing it, which of course is the entire realm of public health. But I was a semi-retired surgeon. They needed somebody to take this job, and I began to bone up on epidemiology, virology, communicable diseases, sexually transmitted diseases, and all the things I hadn't thought about since medical school 40 years prior. So I took the position. It's an interesting position. You basically can't be fired once you've been hired by the Board of Health unless you rob a bank or do something incredibly egregious. You have a great deal of power in terms of enacting things. You can hire and fire all of the personnel of the public health department. You're in charge of vital statistics, inspecting homes, inspecting food, sanitary inspections, like making sure septic tanks are installed properly, making sure children don't have high levels of lead in their bodies. Usually they get this from chewing lead paint in old homes. Then, as I mentioned earlier, sexually transmitted diseases, TB. But you have a group of people who know about these things and are well trained, and I inherited a department of trained people. Typically, this is kind of a political backwater job. A retired doctor takes this. He goes to a Board of Health meeting every 3 months, and then he gives a health officer report, which is prompted to him by the executive director, and then he collects a tiny stipend at the end of the year, and life goes on. But within a few weeks after taking the position, I began to hear about this pandemic in China, and my life changed immeasurably, and I've been pretty much consumed with the COVID pandemic since that time.
Wow. What is it looking like? You mentioned in your description that, you know, it might mean a health department meeting every 3 months. I'm guessing that's not what it's looking like right now, is it?
No, the health department meets every few weeks. I meet every Tuesday and Thursday on a Zoom call with all of the county health officers in Ohio and Indiana around this area. We're Wayne County, I should mention to your listeners, is right on the Ohio County line. Mm-hmm. And I have a TV show called Ask the Doctors, where on community TV every Friday at 2, where people can call in and ask questions about the COVID pandemic. And then I am constantly bombarded with questions from the citizenry asking about things they can do or complaining about things that they can't do. Mm. And I have to remind people periodically that I did not cause the pandemic. It simply coincided with my term.
Well, it's interesting you should mention the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. And we are actually going to come back and talk about that a little bit at the toward the end of your interview. But let's turn now to the opioid crisis. This is a term we've all, unfortunately, been hearing and reading about in the news for years now. So just for a little context, let's start with a definition of what opioids are.
Well, opioids are chemicals that, when taken in the body, combine with opioid receptors in the brain and cause euphoria and a decrease of the sensation of pain. That's their main use medically. They also can be used to, they slow down the movement of the intestine, and so they can be used to treat diarrhea. And they also suppress coughing, so they can be used for that manner. But their main use in medicine has been to treat pain.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, opioids are prescription medication, and their original use was to be prescribed by doctors for patients who were experiencing high levels of pain. Is that right?
That's right. And I think doctors have always, I mean, part of being a doctor is easing suffering and helping people who have pain. The problem with opioids is they become addictive, they cause a euphoria, and if they're taken for a 3 or 4 week period, they change your brain forever. Those opioid receptors in your brain, they want more opioid.
So after only 3 or 4 weeks?
That's
your brain
right.
Chemistry has been changed?
That's right. Your brain chemistry has been changed forever, and it cannot be changed back.
Hmm.
Many people don't understand that. People who are not addicted are puzzled by this and say, well, just don't take the opioids. They're bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
But people who become opioid addicts are driven to stimulate those opioid receptors. And they're also driven not to go into withdrawal. Those opioids last for about 3.5 to 4 hours. At the end of that time, you need more opioids. People are driven to steal, to sell their bodies, to clean out their banking accounts in order to buy more opioids.
You mentioned that there's a draw toward opioids if you're an addict. There's also a rejection or, you know, a panic to avoid withdrawal. Why is that panic so strong? What does withdrawal look like?
Well, it takes 5 days to withdraw from something like heroin. And if you see those depictions in the movies where people are sweating and curled up in a ball, throwing up, those are not, believe it or not, over-dramatizations. That is what withdrawing from opioids is like if you suddenly stop taking these. And there are very few people that can cold turkey stop that. Maybe, and that number of people is probably about 2.5% of people can stop an addiction like an opioid addiction, heroin addiction, by simply not taking the heroin and just living through that 5 days of hell.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis. So you've defined what opioids are, and now you're using the word heroin. So if you could just walk us through when the opioid crisis began and how it came to be, and also where the common ground is between prescription drugs, which are opioids, and heroin, which is also an opioid.
Well, I think most people would agree that Americans, if you look at statistics from Europe or Asia, have always been prescribed more pain medicine than other cultures. Americans demand to be free of pain. I think part of it's a cultural thing. And doctors are eager to step in and help these patients with their suffering. But a game changer happened in the 1990s. Organization called Purdue Pharma, which is owned by the Sackler family, came up with a drug called OxyContin. It was a time-release, powerful opioid, and they reassured all of the doctors that this was not very addictive, if at all, and they enlisted a huge sales force to go around to family doctors and tell them that not only was this a safe medication, but the doctors, if they did not treat this pain, might be guilty of malpractice. The doctors began to prescribe the medicine, and it proved to be a highly addictive drug, and a drug that people could not get off of. You know, typically what would happen, you could have, let me add something that just occurred to me. The salesman for Purdue Pharma began to tell the doctors that pain was actually a fifth vital sign, which is ridiculous, and that all the other vital signs are easily recorded. They're objective numbers. You sit down and you take a patient's pulse. You count the number of respiratory rates they have in a minute. You take their temperature. These are numbers that are quantitated without the patient deciding what the numbers are going to be. Then they would ask the patient, how would you rate your pain from 1 to 10? Well, if you're in pain and you want pain medicine, guess what the number is? It's either 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And then they would be given OxyContin. Well, this fueled such a demand for opioids that there were renegade doctors or scofflaw doctors who would set up clinics. They were just pill clinics. They would just, you came in, they wrote you a prescription, you went and got OxyContin or dihydrocodone or any other opioid that you were wanting. And these doctors, luckily many of them ended up in prison, but they were making hundreds of thousands of dollars just writing opioid scripts.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is that the people who were demanding the prescriptions had become addicts. So they were doing whatever it took to obtain those prescriptions.
Well, they were compelled to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, once your brain is changed chemically by these stimulation of these opioid receptors, you're pretty much compelled to this behavior.
And where does heroin come into the mix?
Well, let me tell you how you get to heroin. People always wonder, well, how does somebody end up injecting heroin? You know, say you're just an ordinary person. Just let me make up a person. Say you're say you're a nurse that's driving down a highway at night on the way home from the hospital. You've got two little kids and a husband, and a deer runs in front of your car. To keep from hitting the deer, you drive the car off the road. It hits a tree. You break your pelvis. You break four of your ribs. You break your left lower leg and your collarbone. You're transported to the hospital. You're in incredible pain. Plus, you're going to have to undergo all of these orthopedic procedures. You're put on opioids to deal with your pain. You get out of the hospital 6 weeks later. The doctor says, you can't have any more pain medicine. Well, you don't have any pain, but you have this incredible feeling of withdrawal because of the fact that you've become addicted over those 6 weeks. Okay, so the nurse goes home. She begins to have withdrawal symptoms, and typically what happens is your grandparents all have pain medicine because they all have arthritis. So you go and visit your grandmother, you raid her medicine chest, and that medicine runs out. Then somebody says, well, you know, Charlie at work has some dihydrocodone. You can probably buy some pills from him. So Charlie's a good guy. You buy 20 pills from him. They're $10 a piece. Then you notice that you're having to spend more and more of your money on pain medicine. This becomes a financial burden. So one of your friends, by now you know other people that are buying illicit opioids, and one of them tells you, you know, you can just sniff heroin. And you will, it's so much cheaper than paying Charlie for the opioids he's selling. So you begin to sniff heroin. And then someone says, you know, if you inject the heroin, you get much better relief of your withdrawal symptoms and it lasts a lot longer. So that's how you go from being a nurse who takes occasional Tylenol for a headache to being somebody that injects heroin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for walking us through that. There are no words for it, really. I would say it's definitely a tragedy. But it really helps to have someone lay out the steps, you know? It helps you understand how this can happen to people that you know and love, you know, people you live right next door to.
Yes, I think half of the patients that I would see in the Suboxone clinic where I act as a medical doctor are addicted in that fashion. And then there are people who have grown up and they may have had parents who were addicted. Their parents gave them pills when they were young. I've seen people who have gotten addicted as 11 or 12 year old kids. Mm-hmm. And these are kids that don't have any, they just didn't have the proper guidance. Under normal circumstances, a child would never be given these opioids or have access to them. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Some people grow up in a criminal element or a poverty-stricken element or a culturally deprived element of society, mm-hmm. and get exposed to opioids that way.
So. It's such a sad story all the way around. We are going to need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Dr. David Jetmore. Back in a second. Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. David Jetmore, who currently serves as the Wayne County Health Officer in Richmond, Indiana. I'd love to know how severe the opioid crisis is at this point, and how does it compare to, say, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, are we seeing a gradual improvement or are things getting worse? Where are we at this point?
Well, you know, from a certain standpoint, things never improve. In other words, if you have 100 addicts, 10 years later, you still have 100 addicts. But to just give you some idea of the numbers, 2.5 million Americans are addicted to opioids, and 70,000 people every year die from opioid overdose. The deaths have steadily risen from 99 on, but they began to level out in 2017. The deaths haven't fallen, but they've leveled out at about around 70,000.
How do you account for that? Why do you think they leveled out in 2017? And do you think that's indicative of improvement?
Well, I think a couple things did. Yes, it's improvement in terms of fatalities. One of the things that we began to do is give out Narcan. It's a drug that can be immediately blocks the effects of opioids. And it can be given just by spraying it into the nose. So the person can be unconscious from an opioid overdose and have the Narcan sprayed into their nose and they'll immediately recover. And this is employed 1 million times last year.
Wow.
So 1 million people overdosed and all but 70,000 of them were saved. Mm-hmm. So that's probably one of the main reasons that these deaths have leveled off. The other thing is their doctors have quit prescribing opioids.
Right.
The opioid scripts are down 37% from the years I have are 2014 to 2019. Mm-hmm. So.
And why have they quit prescribing? Is it illegal now? Or is it unethical? Or why have they quit writing prescriptions for opioids?
It's not illegal, but laws have made it more difficult to prescribe opioids, or more inconvenient, let me say. Mm-hmm. You cannot call in an opioid script the way I might call into the pharmacist an antibiotic or some other medication. But I think doctors in general are cognizant of this opioid crisis and don't want to add to it. Mm-hmm. And we've educated ourselves. We've had many medical articles, many medical meetings about this crisis. The doctors want, you know, we're in this business to help people, not hurt people.
Right.
And I think many of us realize that we were responsible for a lot of those addictions.
And how are doctors helping people manage their pain at this point? Are there other families of drugs that can help people with pain that aren't opioids?
Yes, there are other families of drugs. There's non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or NSAID. There's drugs like Tylenol and, of course, aspirin. These don't have the power of opioids. And there are some people that need opioids for chronic pain, and I worry about those people. I mean, some of these people have been on opioids for years. They've been on a steady dose. They haven't abused the drug, but they've been in need of the drug because of chronic conditions that are associated with chronic, unrelenting pain.
Now, earlier on in our conversation, you referenced some work that you do currently. I believe serving as a physician in a support group, is that right? Is that what you do?
It's not a support group from the standpoint that we encourage someone not to take drugs, although of course we do that. But I work for, on a very part-time basis, a group called Groups, GRUPS, and we treat drug addicts with a drug called Suboxone, which is a drug that is an opioid. And this is, if this drug is given taken once a day, 16 milligrams. It's usually 2 8-milligram tablets that are allowed to melt in your mouth because the medicine is absorbed through your lining of your mouth. This does not cause euphoria, but it relieves the patient of all their cravings. Mm-hmm. And the original goal of the group, the original idea behind this was you would take this drug and then eventually you would decrease your dose over time, maybe over a year or a year and a half, and then you would not take the drug at all. But as I alluded to before, when you become an opioid addict, your brain is changed forever. You still have those opioid receptors. And the statistics for people who get off the Suboxone are not good. I mean, even after being off any drug at all for a year or two, almost all of these people will begin to use opioids again at some point. So the recidivism rate is like all but 2.5. It's probably the same 2.5% of the people that could just quit cold turkey.
Right.
So as I've been with the group, they would say, well, we need to get these people off after a year. Then they began to say, well, we need to titrate them downward after a year and a half. Then they would say, I think we need to titrate them downward after 2 years. But my feeling is, after having worked with these people, I think this is like having diabetes or high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease. It's a chronic condition that has to be treated with medication. You know, you don't go to your doctor if you're a diabetic and say, when can I get off this insulin, or when can I start titrating my insulin doses down? No, you're going to be on the insulin forever. And I think these patients need to be on this Suboxone for the rest of their lives. Now, in addition to the Suboxone, they also get, they meet with other addicts. We've had to do this over Zoom during the pandemic once a week. And I join that meeting once a month with each of the groups, which is usually about 10 or 15 people. And we go over lifestyle. You know, a lot of these people do not have good living skills, so we help them with that. They come from, they're marginalized people. A lot of them have medical and psychiatric comorbid conditions. So they need help, not just with the Suboxone.
What does that help look like? I mean, is it sort of advice, or are there resources offered through that, through groups? Or what exactly does that help look like that's offered?
Well, we'll often have factories come by we'll have job fairs for them. Many of them are having trouble getting work because some of them may be felons. They've been arrested or they're known as drug addicts. One of the things that I've seen change since I began to do this is the amazing disdain that people had for addicts has changed. I think people have begun to realize that this is a chronic problem, that these are real normal Americans who, unlike you and I, are drug addicts.
Yeah.
Just like, unlike you or I, they might have had diabetes. And some of it may have been from a bad choice, but it doesn't matter whether you start the fire in the house with a cigarette lighter or a match. The result is the same. It's fire and ash.
Right. Why do you think that change occurred? Like, why do you think that there is more empathy for addicts and recovering addicts at this point? Is it because the crisis has become so overwhelming that a lot of people actually know someone who has dealt with this personally?
That's exactly right. You know, it's not about reading about somebody in New York City under an overpass who's found dead of a heroin overdose. It's your nephew or your, God forbid, your son who is found dead. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it's not those bad other people, it's your the people you know, your friends, the sons of your friends. Yeah. So it became so vast, the number of people with this problem, that everybody began to know somebody or began to find they were related to somebody with an addiction problem.
Yeah. Now, you were referencing the sorts of help that are available through groups, which is the organization that you work with. What about the kind of help that that other people might be able to offer? Is there anything that we can all do to help in this situation? I mean, are there places we can volunteer or donate money or resources?
There really isn't a role for a volunteer with this kind of a problem, because in order to help these people, I think it requires some special skills most people don't have. Now, having said that, if you have a friend or an acquaintance, then you can certainly help that person as a friend or acquaintance or a relative. If people need help, they usually can find some help by calling the local health department or by calling their family doctor. Many of these people are reluctant to ask for help because they feel like bad people. They may feel ashamed of themselves. They may feel that somehow this is a dirty little secret that needs to be kept hidden. Mm-hmm. Obviously the first step is to realize you have an addiction problem, and then at that point you can try to reach out for help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the word that sticks out for me listening to you talk is shame. I think that's definitely an overwhelming element for people who are dealing with this sort of issue.
Not everyone has such a bright attitude still of drug addicts, and although many policemen have come to realize that we can't arrest our way out of the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
But we have. Indiana is one of 11 counties that has, I'm proud to say, a needle exchange program. The Indiana legislature made having needles illegal. The idea behind that was, if people can't get needles, then they can't inject drugs. So people began to share needles. So the incidence of hepatitis C went up. The incidence of HIV went up because of these shared needles. So we have a needle exchange program where addicts can come in and get clean needles.
How did that needle exchange come to be, considering, as you just said, that it was illegal in Indiana? Did the law change?
No, it's still illegal in 80-some counties it's still illegal to have syringes or needles. But we have the syringe exchange program, which is run by the Department of Health. And every year we see our incidence of HIV and hepatitis C go down because people are not sharing needles. But whenever we go to renew this, there's tremendous opposition by our county prosecutor, who comes out to talk against having this. His argument is, if people get, we shouldn't encourage these addicts in their addiction by giving them needles. Where whether or not people have needles has nothing to do with addiction. But he's focused on the idea that somehow letting these poor addicts exchange needles is a bad thing. So he speaks against it each year. But we got it passed him again this year. So
good. So you've got another
still
another
in
year.
Place.
Good. Let's take another short break, and we'll be right back to talk more with Dr. David Jetmore. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you subscribe to our podcast and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. I'm also hoping you'll visit our website at thelistenpodcast.com, where you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Dr. David Jetmore about the opioid crisis in the United States. Dr. Jetmore, before we go any further, I'd like to talk about resources that you might be able to share for anyone out there who might need to reach out for help, whether for themselves or for a loved one. I know you mentioned that people could call their local health department, depending on what county they live in. Could you give us a website for GROUPS, which is the organization that you've referred to a couple times?
I think, yes, GROUPS has a website on the internet called GROUPS Recover Together. If you happen to be a listener here in Wayne County, you can reach GROUPS by calling area code 765-286-5773. You can probably be referred to help by calling your local health department or your family doctor. Or your minister would probably be able to put you in contact with someone. There are many people that try to treat this addiction without the aid of things like Suboxone or methadone, and I'm not a big fan of that because I don't think it works. I remember, I don't know if it's still going on, but there was a national effort to get people to not take drugs called Just Say No. Mm-hmm. And that program was an incredible failure, despite the incredible amounts of money that went into that, the posters, the talks to kids. That had absolutely no effect on the level of drug addiction in any fashion. But in spite of that, people still believe that if I can just talk to these addicts and point out the error of their ways and how the addiction is making them miserable and affecting their life, that they'll quit doing that. Well, all addicts know that.
Yeah.
There isn't a single addict that says, gosh, I'm really glad to be a drug addict and I really love my life. No, they're in a dilemma. Their brains have been changed chemically forever by the use of opioids, and they have to dance to the music of that piper.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's essential that chemical therapies be part of the solution. I just want to mention you gave out the phone number for GROUPS, and we will be sure to have that on our website where people can look for information. Their website is actually joingroups.com, and we'll also have that information up. Now, at the beginning of our conversation, you were talking a little bit about the position of being the Wayne County Health Officer, and how the very beginning of your term was colored by the COVID-19 epidemic. This sounds a little bit like the perfect storm. The COVID-19 epidemic and the opioid crisis. So could you share with us some of the effects of the pandemic on the opioid crisis? What are you seeing there?
Well, this is a good question, because what you've thought is exactly what has happened. I mean, it's affected every part of the opioid crisis. Things like lab and clinical research on opioid-related projects have been delayed because of the need for, you know, face-to-face dealings with people. The access to mental health gets disrupted. Many people with addictions have mental health problems. Many people with mental health get addicted. Detoxification and admissions are down because of the COVID crisis. Physical distancing disrupts drug supplies. Mm. I'm talking illicit drug supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Then people, if they're using opioids alone, and of course the pandemic's encouraging everyone to be alone, there's no one there to give you any, there's no one there to save your life if you overdose. Mm-hmm. There's decreased opportunities for distractions. You know, one of the things you need to do is distract your mind from taking drugs.
Right.
And if you're by yourself, it's very difficult to do that. You know, one of the things that you haven't brought up, but I'll kind of throw in here, is that people say, well, this is a lot of work and a lot of cost to take care of all these drug addicts. But I happened to see this the other day, the Pennsylvania opioid costs from 2007 to 2016, that's for one state, was $526 million. That was just for arrests, court costs, and keeping these people in jail. But it's the Council of Economic Advisors, I jotted this down, said in 2018 the cost was $696 billion, which is 3.4% of our GDP. From 2015 to 2018, there was a cost of $2.5 trillion. Now, this is the cost, loss of life, incarceration, court costs, loss of the talents of these people.
Yeah.
And these people do things. They're Americans just like you and I.
Right.
Some of them are professional people. They're masons. They're engineers. They come from all walks of life, and they can. We lose all of their work and labor and talent, and so treating these people is a pittance of what the cost is of dealing with what happens to them without treatment.
Right, and it also makes me think about, you know, in the scenario that you were laying out for us, the fictional scenario, you know, these people have children. So there's also the loss of a parent there. You know, you're looking at one child or two or three or however many they have, or grandchildren, who now don't have anyone to help them with their homework or make sure that they're eating well or driving them to school.
Sometimes both parents were lost. I don't know how often before I retired I would see grandparents come in with their grandchildren. They had become the parents because both of the parents were in prison. Aww. Or because both of the parents had died. One mm-hmm. parent had died, one parent was in prison. Mm-hmm. So the human cost to these children and the loss of their parents is incalculable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the future. What do you think can be done going forward to improve the situation, and more specifically to improve treatment for drug addiction?
I think that if the one of the first things is for people to accept drug addicts as sick people that need help, and drug addicts need jobs. We need for these people to be offered work and opportunity and not disenfranchised from the workforce because they have a history of drug addiction. We need more people being able to prescribe Suboxone. Here's one of the things that happens is you'll have somebody that's in prison. They're not on drugs because they can't be, but as I noted before, they've got that chemically altered brain, so they get out of prison and they take the dosage of heroin or whatever it was before they went to prison, and it often is a fatal dose.
Yeah.
Because they're not used to taking it. The people that are being released from prison, we need to set up programs so that they can be put on Suboxone or transitioned out into society without dying. We need more acceptance of society of people who are on Suboxone. I hear people say disparagingly, well, he's just substituted one drug for another. Well, yeah, that's true, but it's a better drug. It's just like the diabetic has just substituted insulin for what his pancreas was making, That's right, but that's a good thing. In order to prescribe Suboxone, you have to take a special course that's given on the internet by the government. It's very involved. It costs a couple $100s to take that course. And only about 6 or 7% of doctors in America can prescribe Suboxone. I'd like to see that number expanded, particularly to doctors in the emergency room. Mm. They're seeing someone come in with a drug overdose, they're saving their life, and then they're sending the patient back home again. This is a perfect time for us to intervene in that patient's life and make an improvement in going forward. Mm-hmm. But these doctors don't have the right to prescribe Suboxone. We need to get more of those doctors as Suboxone prescribers.
Mm-hmm. A similar point that I was wondering about, and it may not be an issue so much anymore because you were saying that doctors aren't really prescribing opioids anymore. But what?
No, they still are. But
okay.
Not like they were before.
Okay.
It's down about a third.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. My question was, what about that point of transition for, going back to your nurse again, she's getting out of the hospital, she's had all these surgeries, or, you know, maybe one by one she's had these surgeries, and she's been on these drugs for a very specific and necessary reason. It seems like it would be very helpful if her surgeons or her doctors could work with her some way to scale down that medicine, you know, scale down those drugs and slowly come off of them instead of sort of sending her home with the medicine and a refill.
Well, you're exactly right. And I don't think that occurs as much now as it did 10 years ago.
Okay.
I think that scenario that I pointed out would be unlikely to happen now. And that nurse that I described, probably that happened to her 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay.
We've self-corrected.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, given your work with recovering addicts and their loved ones, I can imagine that your perspective is quite different than someone who's only read about the opioid crisis online or in a magazine or newspaper. Are there any words you can leave us with about the lens you think we should all be looking through when it comes to this crisis?
Yes, these are our fellow Americans with a horrible chronic disease. It's non-curable, but is treatable, and we need to support them in every way we can. We'll all be better off for it as a society.
Well, I hope those words go out to everyone who's listening here. I think we'll all be better off for hearing them. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. It's been really helpful hearing the facts laid out in such a clear and understandable way. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by Nicole Powers, a recovering addict who has much light to shed on the many complicated facets of the opioid crisis. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, located at the midpoint between Madrid and Valencia in the region of Castilla-La Mancha. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out the conversation we aired with Dr. Jetmore on July 27th, in which he discussed efforts to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 in the United States. Explore the full archive by becoming a subscriber or by visiting our website at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.